I want to begin this morning with our scripture reading, and it's one that I remember clearly my pastor preaching on when I was younger, because I was trying to figure out, based on what he was telling me, and you know, there was no AV, no pictures or anything. I'm gonna use those with y'all to help you out, but there was nothing. I was trying to figure out now which is which, and what happened, and what does that mean now? And so I just put that out there, because these are the kinds of things that we learn. From Genesis, the 9th chapter, and the sons of Noah that went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Ham is the father of Canaan. These are the three sons of Noah, and of them was the whole world overspread. So, you know, the flood wiped out all the people except Noah's family. So from these three sons was the world repopulated. And Noah began to be an husbandman, and he planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine, and was drunken, and he was uncovered within his tent. He was naked in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers without. And Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both their shoulders and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father. And their faces were backward, and they saw not their father's nakedness. And Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done unto him, which means he knew that Ham had told the other two that their father was lying naked in his tent. And he said, "Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren." And Noah said, "Blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant." And Noah lived after the flood 350 years. And this is the kind of teaching that we have about it. Like I said, if they had had AV AIDS when I was younger, I might have gotten this quicker. But here's how it lays out. Noah's flood led to the current dispersion of the races through Shem, Asian, Ham, African, and Japheth, European. This is further evidence of Noah's account in the Bible. Let me take you to this statement from the Texas Freedom Network. But let me hold on just a minute. So you get it, right? These are the three sons. These are the three tribes. And Ham is to be a servant to the other two. We just read it. Texas Freedom Network made a statement about that not too long ago. The idea that racial diversity can be traced back to Noah's sons has been a foundational component of some forms of racism. The belief that Africans were akin to Canaanites and subject to the curse of Ham placed by Noah, in what we just read, undergirded 19th century defenses of slavery and is still cited in racist theory. Now, you might wonder, why in the heck did Texas Freedom Network, with all that's going on, need to spend any time talking about this? Well, I know this isn't current, but this is not long ago history. They wrote this statement after it was brought to their attention that the independent school district of, let's go, Amarillo, in the year 2011-12, the school year 2011-12, had as one part of their curriculum the Bible. And this is one of the visual aids they used: racial origins traced from Noah, Shem, Jews, Semitic people, Ham, African races, Japheth, Western Europeans, Caucasians. There's nowhere for this to go but where it's going. One of the test questions asked about this, a test question from the Amarillo ISD, shows that students were expected to know the chart asking, Shem is the father of the Jewish people. I don't know if there was a question on that test that asked who Ham's people were, and I don't know if there was a question on that test who asked if the curse meant that Ham's people, that African people, were subservient, that they were cursed. But that doesn't matter, because it's all there. 2011, 2012. So what? So what if the Amarillo School District is teaching this? So what if Ham was cursed before all time and Ham's descendants are African, black? So what? So what if that says that, or people are teaching that Africans are cursed and they're being enslaved is God's will? Because that's extreme. Nobody believes that stuff. Well, people still believe the Palestinians have no right to Israel because God promised it to the Jews. And people believe that the earth is only slightly more than 6,000 years old and climate change is a hoax because the Bible tells them so. People still believe this stuff. And people still teach this stuff. And this is where love has got to stop whispering. We are created in God's image. We are black and white and brown and other subtle shades, and we have got to stop whispering. I was going to throw in some things here about Ron DeSantis and Florida being where woke goes to die. I was going to talk about the inhumanity of five police officers beating Tyree Nichols. I was going to talk about so many things. And then I remembered my own words. Remember last Christmas when I told you it wasn't Scrooge we needed to compare ourselves to? It wasn't Scrooge, that horrible miser that cared nothing for anybody, that threw people out of their homes. Wasn't Scrooge we needed to compare ourselves to, it was Marley, whose only transgression, as far as we know, was that he failed to do good. I was going to talk about racism against Asians, Jews, blacks, Latinos, but that's not the talk we need. We, most of us, aren't racist. We don't need to compare ourselves to Ron DeSantis or Derek Chauvin. We're just us. And we need to talk. Just us. Real talk. Black, brown, white. Especially white. Because while black folks and brown folks have been shouting out for one another, for their sons, for their mothers, we white folks have often whispered. Is it safer to sit down and shut up? Yes. But it's not good for the soul. In Race Matters, Cornel West, went straight to the core of America's race issue. He said, our truncated public discussions of race suppress the best of who and what we are as a people because they fail to confront the complexity of the issue in a candid and critical manner. Let's talk, real talk. Here is the fine line to walk for a white person. I cannot compare racism to the homophobia that I experience. I cannot compare racism to the misogyny that I encounter. I cannot speak of black and brown people's experience in ways that bring them across as helpless or as victims. Dr. King assured me that it's all right to tell a man to lift himself by his own bootstraps, but it's a cruel jest to say to a bootless man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. But that does not speak to all black people's experience. I am surrounded by those who have pulled themselves up by their own bootstraps and laid hold of the American dream as though it were really for dark-skinned people too. Which it is, and which it hasn't been. It's a fine line between representation and tokenism, especially if my heart and my head aren't in the right place. So let me start by speaking of black people, proud people, Christian people. And I'm sharing the words of a white man because I'm speaking mostly to white people. And this is one of the ways that we white people need to learn to speak of race. It's not the only way, but it's a very good way. I hope you hear the poetry in these words. Daniel Harrell wrote an article in Christian Century in 2020 called Black Faith Matters. I'm going to go through it because it's important. African American faith was forged in the crucible of slavery. Slaveholding Christians trotted out a Bible they had chained to a culture that diabolically defended the maltreatment of those judged as hardly human. They'd misuse passages such as this from 1 Peter, slaves, in reverent fear of God, submit yourselves to your masters, not only to those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh. Yet the same Bible, exploited by men to enslave black lives, also liberated black faith. 1 Peter continues, it is commendable if someone bears up under the pain of unjust suffering because they are conscious of God. If you suffer for doing good and you endure it, this is commendable before God. Now, I know that's not sitting well with everybody, but listen to this. Slaves heard tell of a God who is Lord of the oppressed, of Jesus, dark-skinned and poor, born to a teenager out of wedlock, wrongfully arrested and hung on a tree by a state-sanctioned mob, but then rightly raised from the dead and victoriously vindicated, all to God's glory. The horror of the cross bears its strange fruit in a wondrous and inexplicable capacity to rise above hatred, above prejudice, above injustice and evil, with true love, pure grace, and genuine joy. Black Christians suffer and say Sunday is coming. They persevere and put on their praise. Christ died and we thank the Lord for it and call it good news. This is the enduring mystery of the gospel and the heartbeat of black faith. There's some poetry there. So let me speak of race. How do you talk about racism without victimizing people of color and without shaming white people? How do you lay out the case for structural racism in a way that doesn't make the white people despondent, make them feel like the problem is too large? Yeah, it's safer for a white woman to sit down and shut up, but evidently, it's safer for white men as well, especially ones with privilege. You've seen what happened to Prince Harry? He didn't choose the right words. He left everything he had, and we can talk about how bad what he had was, but he left everything he had to love his family, his wife, his children. He might not have used the right words. He might not be up on all the latest research. But he didn't whisper. Let me speak my truth. And let me say this. It's not risky to spout my statistics. It's not risky to put a black man in the pulpit. It's risky as heck to let my white mouth speak of race. But here we go. It has always been my dream for our church to show forth the colors of the rainbow, the human rainbow, not just the pride rainbow. But I was at a Ta-Nehisi Coates event on MLK Day, and the moderator reminded us that the percentage of Austin's population that is black is around 6. The black population of Austin proper is around 6%. And she said, all of us here at this talk, and it's only a handful. And sitting there, I had to finally accept that unless the black population of Austin grows, and we can have something to do with that, but unless the black population of Austin grows, and unless we start pilfering or recruiting from other congregations, we are not going to reach that magic number of no race represented greater than 50%. So I have to accept that what we must do in our largely white congregation is to commit ourselves to anti-racism. But that's hard. And it draws up so many things. And then I saw a sign that I thought, this might be it. I've used it today. Here's what we can do. We can reject racism. Reject it. When we see it in others, when we see it in ourselves. Let me talk frankly. One of my kids blew up a potato in the microwave. I hadn't warned my kid about not blowing up a potato in the microwave because I had never blown up a potato in the microwave, and I wasn't sure it was a thing. It's a thing, y'all. But here's the point. Sometimes you don't know a thing is a mistake until you make it. Sometimes white people aren't being racist, we're just being stupid or sheltered or privileged or any number of other things, but still we're pretty decent folk, many of us. We say dumb things. I don't have time to show you this morning, but Google this thing, the dumb things that white people say, and it's got a white person and a black person. And it's got all the things that white people say to black people coming out of a black person's mouth. Things about your hair. Things about your race. Google that sometime. And watch the movie You People. Not only is it about a love story between a white man and a black woman, and from the moment that movie starts, you know they are perfect for each other, and you cheer for them. But can they make it? Her black family, his white family, oh, there's another little wrinkle. He's Jewish. They're Muslim. Watch that movie. Read this book. It's called We Are Not Like Them. It's written by a white woman and a black woman. It alternates chapters. I'm going to give you some spoilers, but that's okay. They happen early in the book, and you can go. So they are best friends. They grew up together. The white woman basically lived with the black family growing up because her family was so dangerous. They are best friends. The white woman is married to a white police officer who shoots a young black man, an unarmed black man, on his way home. You can imagine all the crowds descending and the anger in the city and everything, and the reporters, the media, the press, find out where the woman and her police officer husband live. And they surround the house and they beat on the door. And they want a statement, and she's scared and she doesn't know what to do, this white woman. But she comes to the door, and when they start hounding her and pressing on her and pressing on her, one of the first things out of her mouth is, "My best friend is black." And that was like throwing red meat to the wolves. And I knew it when I heard it. I knew what was going to happen then. But here's what happens when a white woman decides to talk about race. It matters that her best friend was black. It matters that she grew up in a black home. Does it make her understand what it is to be black? No. Does it give her a pass? No. But it matters. You tell me I'll still be talking about race in 10 years if every white person says my best friend is black. We make lots of mistakes, but those things matter. It matters that when my daughter got married, two of her bridesmaids were black. It doesn't give me a pass. It's nothing to brag about. But you bet it matters. It matters that my grandchildren are Ramirez's, that they are Mexicans. It doesn't give me a pass. It doesn't mean I'm not racist, but it matters. If we can go out and befriend each other and speak up for each other and make mistakes like blowing up the potatoes in the microwave, it will matter. And I want to tell you, every time I have reached out to a person of color and said, "Help me," they have, with grace. When I talk to an Asian friend about what is it like to be the only Asian in the restaurant, they have talked to me with grace. When I tried to learn my Spanish, not one person who speaks Spanish criticized me or ridiculed me. They smiled and encouraged me. When I ask black people, "Tell me what it feels like. Tell me, is it different this time that Tyree Nichols was killed by black officers instead of white? Tell me." And every one of them has spoken to me with patience and kindness. I'm going to wrap this up. And here's what I want you to know. Sometimes it's not about checking your privilege so much as it is about reading the room. 60 years, and I haven't lived a day without my white privilege. I don't really know how to check it. It's as present as my skin. But when I make pronouncements about race and racism and alliances, I need to carefully pay attention to how my comments land. I need to remember that there is such a thing as intent and such a thing as impact. And this is where I need those of you with brown and black and Asian skin to speak up. You speak up. Tell me, teach me, correct me, encourage me. Even when it's easier to sit down and shut up. Even when you're tired. So tired. Because we're going to carry each other over the finish line. We'll all be tired. And this is through. Think on these things.